I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Matt Rader joins me now. The acclaimed writer has just published a new book, Visual Inspection. It nearly defies definition, so who better to talk to about it than the author himself? I'll ask Mr. Rader about how he explains the book to people as well as its genesis. From childhood, the author has had to deal with illness that doctors couldn't explain. During a period of profound illness, he decides to document the reflection and observations he's made. Some are poems, some are pieces of prose, some don't fit in the lines of the page. All reflect in some way meditations on pain, resilience, as well as access. We see the challenge of disability manifested in pieces that are redacted. I'll ask Matt about those and what those mean not only for the person creating such a piece, but for the reader, and whether that might be illustrative. Matt Rader is the author of four books of poems: Desecrations, A Doctor Peddled, Her Bicycle Over the River Arno, Living Things, and Miraculous Hours. He is also the author of the short story collection What I Want to Tell Goes Like This. He is a member of the faculty at the University of British Columbia Okanagan's Department of Creative Studies. This new book is published by Knightwood Editions. He joined me from Kelowna, British Columbia, where he lives. Please welcome to the Planta Online program, Matt Rader. Professor Rader, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Do you know that both you and Richard Florida have done this podcast?
No, I'm so happy to have something in common with Richard Florida.
Something in common, finally, right?
Yeah, it's been so long.
He comes into focus in the book at least two or three times, and I guess you have some thoughts on him and, I guess, that which he preaches.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair to Richard Florida, I'm not really an expert on all of the things that he has espoused, but part of my research, or an aspect of my research, had to do with cultural mapping at one point, and when I was on the walk that is narrated in this book, I kept thinking about the way in which space is thought of in contemporary design, civic design, and especially the downtown part of Kelowna, which it's a strange space, it has a strange connection, like the relationship between commerce and culture and livability is in collision very much in that space, and which is also something that Florida has been about, although from what I understand, he has taken different sides of the same argument over the years.
Depending on which book is out, I guess, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't want to be that cynical. I think let's allow that Mr. Florida may have changed his mind over time.
Sure. Yeah. People are allowed to change their mind, but it's I guess peculiar when someone does that when they have become famous, where they've done well, espousing something else at one point in their career, something that made them quite. I was going to say wealthy, but I guess authors don't really make money in this country. But have sold a lot of books, I guess, right?
Yeah, I'm sure Mr. Florida does fine for himself, but I really don't know.
Yeah.
I think there is something about taking up a position that benefits you and then switching sides, and which I think is actually entirely reasonable, but one needs to narrate that change in a fulsome way, right? And and this is a version of what it means to repent, go beyond your mind, go beyond the original position you had.
Yeah.
And when you tell that story and you can say how that happens, it's actually quite powerful. But when we do it in a more cynical way, when we don't tell it, it comes across as cynical, I think.
Yeah. I'm sure people will ask you what visual inspection is about, and so, I mean, how do you explain the book to them?
That's such a good question. It depends a little bit on who I'm speaking with. The book has many different topics, I would say,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, in a room that full of people who are, let's say, when I go to conferences on disability and art, I talk a lot about access and disability when I'm talking to a literary crowd, I will talk about aspects of poetry and form. But the simplest way to answer it, I think, is that I have lived with a lot of immunological disorders all my life, and they are inexplicable. Their symptoms are inexplicable, and I think many people have this experience of pain and illness that that you can't really say what it is and or when it will occur, when you will have these symptoms, what those symptoms will be like, what their duration is like. And I wanted to make a book that was similarly uncategorizable, that had that allowed for that kind of shifting and changing in the way that the book moved. So that's what I think visual inspection is. The visual inspection is influenced by my own experience of the changing conditions of my health.
Who's Taryn?
Taryn Goodwin is a local artist who, or not a local artist, she lives in the Comox Valley. She was local to me at a time. Mm-hmm. And she does a lot of work in around access and writing and thinking about systems like universities, schools, and how people can seek out comfort within those spaces. And I would consider her a social practice artist. She apprenticed with Carmen Papalia, who is a fairly well-known, internationally well-known social practice artist. Mm-hmm. And social practice art takes these kinds of ideas about access and finding comfort and thinks of them as expressions of aesthetics, as expressions of art making, rather than the object itself as a work of art, but the social relationship as a work of art.
You write that there's one line in the book that I found interesting. You write that she believes what you say in terms of,
yeah,
of like things that you're feeling. She understands that, she gets that. And so one wonders then, does that mean too many people don't?
Oh, yeah. I mean, recently, that is one of my favorite things about Taryn. Taryn is somebody who I know also suffers from a similar kind of pain experience to mine. And what I write in the book, one of the things that I love about her is we've never discussed the medicalized version of that.
Mm.
We've never discussed what the doctors tell us that's wrong with us.
Yeah.
Rather, we give prominence and privilege to our experiences of our bodies and how we communicate them to each other. But I sort of refer to it in the book. I have seen so many specialists and so many different modes of healthcare, and many of them don't believe you or believe me. Recently, I held a roundtable on disability and access at UBC Okanagan,
mm-hmm,
where I invited students to speak. And one of the things that I could see so quickly when they started speaking was their relief that they were in a room where other people understood what their experiences were without them having to talk and try to help people get there, that there is a certain baseline shared experience that can be communicated simply by being in the presence of somebody who has had a similar experience. I know that people with addiction, for example, have this experience at AA and places like that, which is part of what is powerful about those spaces.
Yeah. We really can't see the pain of another person, and that's something that recurs throughout the book that got me thinking as I was reading it, that we often assume what that pain is or what it isn't. And for a lot of people, I mean, too many people, I guess, are superficial enough that if they don't see it, it's very easy for them to discount. And that's something that you write in the book is something that you've tried to do over the years. And I think a lot of people would be better off if they did think about this from time to time or regularly, is how can one listen to the pain of others? And so having gone through and are going through what you've gone through, do you have a question, an answer to that question, say?
I don't have a definitive answer. I think I have have some approaches, which is actually I think all one really wants. My answer is that you don't want a definitive universal answer for this is how you do it.
Yeah.
Or these are the things you look at. Rather, you want to be alive to what's presented to you, and open to what people tell you, both verbally and in their way they present. We're closed off enough from our own experiences, which is also part of this book. I mean, I really set out in this book to ask myself a question about how I might understand my own experience better, have more access to what my body is doing and telling to me. And I think because we are so limited, even in our own understanding of our own experiences, it becomes a real challenge to understand other people. I think one disposition we could have is to believe people, and rather than doubt them. That doubting is a really important factor in critical thinking,
yeah.
And it's an important way to approach. It's very powerful to doubt what is there, and I think that I would never suggest that we should do away with doubting. However, we can also test things by believing them, and we can approach other people with less immediate skepticism and more curiosity. My own experience is that, like, listening to my own body is that uh-huh. there are expressions of pain in my own body that I didn't understand were necessarily expressions of pain. And there were approaches to assuaging that pain that I hadn't considered. And so that at least for me, helped me recognize a broader range of presentations of pain and suffering in the people I meet.
Yeah, that's the other thing that I was thinking about as I was reading your book, Visual Inspection, is that we don't like talking about being ill, whether it's ourselves or other people. Especially if it's ourselves, we tend to think that in some cases it might gross people out, or they just don't need to be bothered with whatever it is what we're contending with, and so we'll just keep it to ourselves. Is that something that you thought about, say?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a really big. There's so much shame attached with illness. Also, the word disability, when it arises, people have a lot of ideas about what it means to be disabled. That's why, in fact, I often don't talk about disability, but rather about access, because access is something that all people negotiate at all times. Within disability, critical disability communities, or there's a sort of saying that if you live long enough, everyone becomes disabled at some point. And everyone becomes ill at some point, and everyone has a body. And some of us have to negotiate access in a more robust way because of the systems, the social constructions around us, the physical and social constructions around us. But we are all figuring out how to hear someone better, how to get a better view, how to be more comfortable. I don't think I think that applies to all people. And so I try to think about access rather than disability or illness, but it is really worth acknowledging how hard it is to speak about what we understand typically as weakness. I actually think there's quite a bit of power in understanding and accepting weakness. This is the idea of weakness as a strength is a really millennia old idea.
Yeah.
It comes deep in wisdom traditions all over the world, and it's for a reason. When we can accept that what's true, we are in a much stronger position than when we deny the truth and claim strength.
Throughout the book, there are pieces that feature redactions. Some of them are redacted completely. Some are just redacted in some parts. And so, as I was reading it, I guess I was curious as to what was redacted. And then I realized now that it's your way of showing the reader, I guess, the challenge of access, and it's a way for a reader to see sort of the what it's like to sort of get around, I guess, and getting around this book is made one more interesting and another more challenging by what's redacted. The act of redacting itself, how do you see what you've done there?
Well, I like your interpretation. I think that's certainly part of what I've been thinking about. I think that, like, I wrote somewhere in the introduction something about when you go looking for something, it's sometimes just the searching for a particular thing blinds you to what's actually there. And I'm using the word blind in a particular way here. Part of what I want to show with the redaction is that even when something is covered up, the semantic value, like the letters which we decode semantically into meaning, there remains a presence. And that presence has a power even when we don't know what it is.
Mm.
And I think that in fact it passes on information to us even when we don't know what it is. And that information creates expectations and relationships, and we have all of those things are happening well before we ever actually, you know, read a word, as in decode the semantic signs that are on a page. So I think that that's also another aspect of what I'm pointing to.
Yeah, the another thing that I was thinking about as I was reading the book is this idea of what healthy is. And
yeah.
We hear that a lot, you know, oh, he's healthy, she looks healthy. And that has taken on a significant meaning for you. I mean, do you answer that question in your mind as to what healthy is? I mean, is healthy just the absence of pain, say, or suffering?
I don't know that I have a real definitive answer. I think that for myself, health has to do with a kind of clarity of mind and body, for that matter. One of the main people one of the people I write about quite a bit in the book is the person who's leading us on this walk, and his name is Carmen Papalia, and I mentioned him previously.
Mm-hmm.
He's somebody who is legally blind. He calls himself a non-visual learner, which he does partly as comedy and partly as like a point. He's trying to pay attention to a different aspect of who he is by saying that. He's also suffered quite a few other kinds of health issues, and he is also one of the most generous, happiest, kindest, sweetest people I have ever known.
Mm.
And in a way, I can't think of a healthier person than Carmen Papalia. And yet, I think by many other standards, he would not be considered healthy exactly. But his presence is entirely healthy. It's very robust and vibrant.
Yeah, that's the thing about it, because a lot of people, we hear this in the press and the sort of, but, you know, the epidemic of chronic pain.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was reading Visual Inspection, I thought, well, yeah, someone can be healthy and yet carry some pain with them, whether that be physical or emotional or otherwise.
Absolutely.
And I think that we're wiser when we realize that that's what happens to a lot of people around us, people that we encounter, say, on the bus or, you know, in our places of work. Or, I mean, we would be... I don't know. We do judge people a lot, don't we? And we form opinions about them so quickly that we overlook things like that.
Yeah, we compete with each other,
yeah.
And we use any kind of differences that we can find, and often the differences are actually imaginary. But we find we create differences in order to elevate ourselves or to get ahead, so to speak. And also, quite frankly, I think out of fear, because if we are able to create a difference between, say, ourselves and Carmen or anybody else, myself included, then maybe maybe that means we don't have to suffer as we imagine these other people suffering. I don't know. I can answer it. I know that for me, working with Carmen and with Taryn and with many other artists who are working in what's sometimes called disability arts, I became just excited about the possibilities that different bodies and different experiences offer.
Yeah.
The way they the way our bodies change shape, and the way different movements through space and through buildings and through bureaucracies, the different embodiments really challenge those constructions. And as an artist, they create new possibilities, or they reveal possibilities that have been concealed for a time. And for me, that's what's exciting about it. And of course, there is a social justice element to it, but in a way, I'm less interested in protesting and more what, like my colleague Nicola Harwood would say, in inviting in. Like, I don't want to push back. I want to invite you in.
Yeah, no, I'm wondering, when you're writing a book like Visual Inspection, when you're telling people about your experience, do you spend a lot of time thinking about why you, do you wonder about fate, say? I mean, a lot of people put their stock in karma, in that it sorts everything out, that say bad people get what they deserve, or good people will get what they ought to later on, you know, in same measure, right?
Sure.
I've always thought karma was silly, because, I mean, people are born sick or ill, and, you know, karma doesn't explain that.
No, karma does not explain it, and neither does God or any of the other great explanations, and neither does medicine, for that matter, or science. My own experience is that, the best I can get out of most Western medicine is an explanation or a description of my symptoms, and to some degree an explanation of what's happening when the symptoms occur, but why my body would attack its own flesh or overreact to innocuous encounters with other molecules, there is no explanation for this. And I'm not, to some degree, I'm just not sure that having an explanation, I like the idea of maybe having like hundreds of explanations.
Yeah.
And like being able to pick and choose depending on which moment you're in, who you're speaking with, or which story seems most sense for this moment in your life. But no explanation would be definitive of myself anyway, and my own. I don't think I'm special. You know what I mean? I don't think I'm cursed. I don't think I'm special. I know that there are many. In fact, I really think everybody has some kind of pain and suffering. It doesn't matter what part of your life you go through, and if by some miracle you've never had pain and suffering, that in itself seems like maybe the most unfortunate thing.
Yeah,
it's just a dimension of being human, and I'm kind of interested in as many dimensions of my existence as I'm able to access.
Now, the pieces in the book, I call them pieces because some of them read as poetry, some of them are visual manifestations, some of them could count as essays, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
when you're writing these out, these thoughts, these observations, are you writing for someone else? Do you have an audience in mind, say?
Yeah, I mean, like, quite literally, the book started out as notes. Like, the book is the two major sections are notes and endnotes, and I was making notes about what we were up to and what we were thinking about, and I say we because that included my collaborators, Carmen Papalia and Jordan Scott, and a number of my research assistants at the university, like Clayton McCann in particular. And when I was writing down, I don't know that I have a specific audience, but I have people like Jordan and Carmen and Clay and Taryn in mind. Like, I want to be able to write something that they will understand and that would seem accurate to them. So in many ways, you know, pretty much everybody who has any sort of substantial appearance in the book read drafts of the book well before it ever came out. And those are the people who I'm sort of first speaking to. And beyond that, originally I thought I was simply writing an essay. Mm-hmm. Like, that was what I started out doing. And I thought I was going to write, you know, an essay that might be in The Walrus or something like that.
Sure.
But it became a different form altogether. And so to some degree, I was thinking about perhaps I was writing to other poets. By the time I got near the end of the book, I was definitely thinking about writing to other people whose lives were inflected with a similar kind of experience of health and ill health. And I wanted to at least identify, like, situate myself and try to be as vulnerable as I knew how to be at the moment about my own experience. So that other people who were featured in the book or who were felt akin to that experience didn't feel like I was talking about them from the outside.
Yeah. So I'm sure throughout this process, throughout these years, that you were taking notes. There are probably more that are included.
Much more.
So what's the process in deciding what's in the book? I mean, are there moments that you left, are there notes that you left out because they probably showed you a little more vulnerable than you'd like the reader to see you as, perhaps?
I think actually it was this might sound a little bit weird because this is a strange book, and I'm not sure that clarity is the word I would describe from this book, but it was an effort in, like, stripping away to get closer to what I felt was most important. Jordan Scott helped me with this quite a bit. It's also true that, like, I tried to write a version of this book multiple times, and they're completely different. Like, they're not even, you wouldn't recognize them as being related to this book at all. I tried to write a very academic version of it. I tried to write a much even more experimental version of it. So it's a bit of a process of trying to strip away some things, and then, of course, make connections where we needed to, and then because it's a kind of intergenre book that is, you know, part essay and part poetry, it borrows from what people call lyric inquiry, or the idea of moving through thinking in terms of meditation and lyric rather than analysis and narration, or maybe giving more privilege to the jumps that lyric have. And so to some degree, I also thought about the music of the book, the way the book, there are pages where it's just one line on a page, for example, and I wanted to have a pacing and a space that represented formally in the book. And that's also part of how we decided what could be there, what could stay, what needed to go.
When you look back at some of these pieces, because they're written at specific times in your life, what is it like to read them again? Does it evoke certain feelings or certain memories, say, and do some of those feelings, say, manifest themselves physically even?
Yes, that's a really good question. It's a really great question. That's one of the most interesting things, is to recognize how much how connected physical sensation and memory can be. And I think probably a lot of us have that experience of, like, we can remember a moment. I often use embarrassment. Can you think of the most embarrassing thing that ever happened to you, and you picture it, and as soon as you picture it, you can feel that embarrassment again?
Yeah, yeah.
In writing the book and rereading it now at different points, sometimes it can be really, the sensation is affirming. Sometimes it's a bit chilling. There are some really hard things that I at least allude to in the book, and mm-hmm. I think that those they cause a kind of momentary pause for me sometimes, especially when I'm writing about other people, actually.
Yeah.
And sharing about the people who are close to me and their experiences, all of whom I, like, you know, they wouldn't be in there if I hadn't had explicit permission from them, but it's still it feels super vulnerable to share somebody else's story, especially around these kinds of things. And I also have the experience of basically like a half a year or 8 months out of finishing the manuscript, I have many more thoughts.
Mm.
I have things I would add, and directions I would take, and my own experience of writing. This is my sixth book. My own experience of writing is that that's pretty normal. That
I
by the time it comes out, I really like everything about writing, right up to the point that I hand it into the publisher, and then I want to start doing the next thing. So, which I don't mind, which isn't to say I dislike speaking with you, but I'm very grateful, actually, to be able to talk about it. But for me, the real joy is the making part. So by the time I would like to make new things. And, I'm actually writing something for a journal based on some of this work, and I just have had further thoughts about what this project even was, and that I didn't include, and so it's nice to be able to kind of continue that thinking in new formats.
Well, long may it continue, and I must say that our time has just whizzed by. I've so enjoyed talking to you today. It's a very thoughtful book, and it got me thinking about a lot of the things that I see around me, and it made me check, I guess, some of the conceptions or misconceptions I've had about things I see. Congratulations on this book, Matt, and good luck with it. I so appreciate your time today. Thanks for this.
Yeah, thank you for the thoughtful questions. I really appreciate the interest.
The book is called Visual Inspection. It is published by Knightwood Editions. Matt Rader joined me on the line from Kelowna in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.